The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, good afternoon, listeners. It's already afternoon. At least it is here in California. Thank you all for tuning in today. We have open lines for you. I'll get to that in just a minute, but let me run through our usual typical announcements. For those of you who would like to call and participate in open lines, our toll-free phone number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we don't use call screeners and we have only the one line. And if it's an active open lines day, the line may be busy. So if you think you've been waiting a long time, send me a polite note and tell me you're waiting, and I'll see if I can move our caller along to make room for you and other callers. Again, that number is 1-866-687-7223. We can also take your email questions and comments, and that is Dr. Space, DrSpace, at thespaceshow.com, which is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So we do have a newsletter there, and we will upload the newsletter for the week sometime later this evening. And it always goes up Sunday after the Sunday Space Show. So our website, Full Dose Newsletter, has all of the information about the upcoming programs for the week, guest bios, and it's the only place where we have the future events section. And then, again, if we have to modify our schedule during the week, which sometimes does happen, we do it first on the website newsletter. So I suggest that you check it from time to time just to be certain that nothing's changed. It's real easy to find. It's in the middle of our homepage at thespaceshow.com, and you just look for the big letters, newsletter. So everything we do is archived on our website. You can download the shows or listen to them right off of our website. And you can do the same on our blog, thespaceshow.wordpress.com. On the blog, you can also exchange notes with other listeners and oftentimes with the guest as well. There's a store on our website. Look in the upper left-hand corner, Space Show Gear. Please do check it out. Of course, to me, the most important button is the Support the Space Show button, because we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we rely on your fundraising and donations to support the Space Show and keep our programs coming to all of you free of charge, and so far always available on archives, even going back to the original show in 2001. If you have any questions about OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, our 501c3 status, or donating to the Space Show, check us out at OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, or please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do thank you all for your continued and new support. It's really vital for us, and it really does keep us on the air. Please do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, but everyone has permission to download the shows and share them and pass them around with people they think will find the shows interesting. And there's very few restrictions. Don't do anything commercial with the programs. Please don't edit them. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. We podcast with Gigadial.net, and we thank Andrew for his service. We are in iTunes and a host of other places on the web. If you have any issues about how to listen to us or get our podcast, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our RSURL for subscribing to our podcast is on the website and both of our newsletters. And then do also remember that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote Cooperative Solutions for Space Security. For more information, please do go ahead and visit their website, www.swfound.org. Great organization, lots of good papers and work that you'll get exposed to on the website. So today is an open line show. It's the last one for March. Can you believe March 2015 is almost over? Time seems to be going really, really fast. So on open lines, all space topics are welcome. All science and STEM topics are also welcome. And we encourage you to call if you're a first-time caller. Remember, the only dumb question is the one that is never asked. So from our books, there are no dumb questions that are asked. So we do hope that many of you will call. And again, we do just have the one toll-free line that is available. And if you think you've waited too long because it's busy, then go ahead and email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll be happy to see if I can move the caller along. So a couple of things that we can talk about, and by the way, the toll-free line is available right now if any of you want to call us. We always seem to get a slow start on these open line shows, but it is available right now, 1-866-687-7223. NASA announced a few days ago that it was going to go out and grab a boulder, not an asteroid, to orbit the moon as its ARM mission, so that asteroid retrieval mission. So I only read a couple of articles about it, and I read them in a hurry because it's been a really busy week for me. So I'm not sure if the boulder is the same as the ARM mission. They're just reclassifying the small asteroid a boulder. If it is in addition to also getting a small asteroid, or if a boulder is a replacement to a small asteroid, and I don't know how big the boulder is, but maybe some of you are interested in this project and would like to comment on it and what you think of changing the asteroid retrieval mission to a boulder mission. So we'd like to hear about you from that. As reported yesterday in the Space News, it looks like NASA is going ahead with a plan to cancel the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter program that has been orbiting the moon for many, many years and doing some really great data collection and sending data back, and also Mars Opportunity. And I understand the cancellation is because of budgetary issues. I guess these missions cost a couple of million or several million dollars a year, and they don't want to pay for it anymore. So I think 2016 is the cutoff date, although I may have gotten that wrong, and that may be a little bit too early. But what do you think about canceling Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Opportunity? They both still have a lot of life left in them. I, of course, think that this is really a bad decision and that Congress ought to allocate sufficient funds to keep these vital and really valuable, good projects going. I mean, they have been beyond impressive, and to cancel them because the United States of America can't afford them just doesn't sit right with me. But what do you think? I'd like to hear your comments on that as well. And I got an email before the show started from our listener Bijan in Sweden, and he threw it out for comment on the show, so I'm going to read it to you. And somebody may want to comment on this. And as I said, the toll-free line is open, and you can start calling. I'll put you on hold while I'm reading Bijan's email, and I'll bring you right up on air. The toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Here is a comment from Bijan, and the title is, "The ISS International Space Station shows our lack of readiness to send humans to Mars." Caller's on hold, so please stay with us, caller, while I read this email. I think that the, and this is again Bijan in Sweden, "I think that the ISS illustrates how far away we are from being able to design and construct a crewed spaceship to Mars. Besides the popular topics of how we are lacking launchers and landers and radiation shielding and microgravity mitigation, many other technologies also seem to be lacking. One example, most of the systems on board the ISS are monitored and teleoperated in real time from the ground, and yet the ISS crew of six today spends almost all of their time on maintenance. On board a spaceship to Mars, the crew of four or fewer must be able to do much of the job themselves. I think that if in the 1970s Apollo had been followed up by an ambition to send humans to Mars, we would have encountered similar problems as the space shuttle and the ISS have, and we would still today not have sent any humans to Mars. So some of you may want to comment on that, and you know, I'm happy to read it again if you need me to read it again. Well, we do have a caller on hold. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you? Where are you?
Good afternoon, David. It's Michael, listener in New Hampshire.
Debbie Downer is back with us.
Yes, I am.
So what are you going to Debbie Down us with today, or are you upbeat?
No. Unless you want me to down something, I can perfectly do that. But I thought you said something a little bit, not really upbeat, but kind of neutral. Yesterday there was a news article from Russia Times, I believe, and it was touting this agreement that NASA and Roscosmos came about, the follow-on to the ISS. And, you know, we were all, that was kind of eye-popping. And not long after that article started getting floating around the Internet, Jeff Fuss came out with an article in Space News saying, no, there is no agreement for a follow-on to the International Space Station between the Russia and the United States. But apparently there has been some... From what I gathered, there's been some talk of it.
I read the news articles and stuff, but I don't have any information about it. But I suspect that Russia wouldn't do anything at this point because it's probably too early for them, given they'd probably like to see some other things happen either in Russia or elsewhere before they, you know, commit to what they're going to do with the ISS. Doesn't that make sense to you?
Well, I don't know what makes, you know, with Russia nowadays, nothing really makes sense. From a Western perspective and not having all the information, nothing that comes out of their media really makes a lot of sense because it's pretty much very much, how can you say, embellished. They go overboard with it on what the facts really are. So you really, it's hard to say what makes sense or what doesn't make sense coming out of Russia nowadays.
Yeah, but I mean, when I talked to Anatoly Zak on either Hotel Mars or on the space show, and he talks about the Russian program, he says a lot of this is just, you know, posturing and blowing off, you know, voices, because they don't know where they're going to be budget wise with their economy, with their new spaceport, with lots of issues that are a priority for them, and they don't really know their situation and the deal in the Ukraine and all of that. So how this will play out probably won't take shape until the 11th or 12th hour.
Well, I kind of agree with that. I think Anatoly's in a better position because he really focuses his work on the Russian space program.
Yeah, that's all he that's what he addresses, right?
I mean that's his specialty. But I mean, I agree with him that a lot of what they do is posturing, especially this big thing, you know, that everybody's been getting excited about, where they say after 2024 they're going to take their modules and go play somewhere else. I just rolled my eyes and say, okay, yeah, whatever. That's what they say now, but what are they going to say next week or 2 weeks down the road?
I asked him about that on the last show, and he said they want to have a place for their cosmonauts to go and do research and stuff like that, and they may not be able to afford to go any place other than to continue in the partnership with the ISS, and that does afford their cosmonauts a destination to do what Russia wants to do. So he says it's way too early to believe anything they say is really being credible.
Yeah, I think it'd be a waste. I mean, I think it'd be a big waste of federal money, in the sense that we're basically after, if they decide to have to discontinue the ISS after 2024, we're basically saying, well, we've used this all up. No sense. You know, we've spent billions, probably trillions of dollars on this, but we're all done with it now because this is not useful anymore. We're going to just splash in the ocean. And we're going to go spend another $100 billion or so and build a new one and do the same thing. You won't hear me saying this much, but I really think, you know, the big point to come from it, and I think what NASA's trying to really get get the private sector to do is have the private sector build a space station. And I know Bigelow has been talking about this for years, getting up there and creating one, possibly with a partnership with NASA, and taking it from there.
Well, we're a long ways from that too.
We're a long ways from that. But I think what really struck me yesterday about that, that there was even a hint of that, was, you know, the fact this would extend the potential of commercial crew and commercial cargo, because, you know, right now they really are the only markets for both those those endeavors. And after the ISS goes away, if there's nothing to follow on, that's going to dry up.
Well, yeah, and then what's Dragon and what are the others going to do, and where the astronauts and all going to go? So they need something.
Yeah, and it's kind of like what I made. After Zimmerman came on, after you posted, I made a comment in the blog. You know, because he made a comment about the space tourism market, and my comment in the blog was, you know, what space tourism?
Well, you were talking about orbital tourism, so let's get
there. Yeah, orbital tourism. I mean, I really, other than what Russia has going right now, with you know, sending celebrities up, and of course Richard Garriott, who I've actually had you know, email chats with Richard. He's a pretty interesting guy. You know, other than that, I mean, where is the market for it?
Well, if Bigelow ever does get his space stations up, there might be a market with Bigelow to his private space station for some sort of orbital tourism. And you know, if the government market starts to disappear, maybe SpaceX would use Dragon to send six people on three or four orbits around the Earth or something like that, you know, for a nice chunk of change.
Well, so in the bottom line, it would be a big chunk of change. And I kind of got cynical, you know, one time in the, well, not one time in the forums. I get cynical a lot of times when I argue in the forums. But people were talking about, you know, I want to see true commercial space. I want to see space tourism. And I told them, I said, you know, I will believe that space tourism is valid and effective when I can go online and buy a ticket for the price of an air flight across the ocean to another country, and then I'll say commercial, you know, true commercial private space travel has arrived.
Well, I think that's an unrealistic definition, if that's what you're using to define space tourism, because commercial space tourism to me would be that some company somewhere has an operational space tourism where you can buy tickets on some sort of a scheduled arrangement, and regardless of what it cost, and then you can show up and you can go. Whether you have to go through training or not is another story. But I certainly wouldn't define it as the price point that you're suggesting, and that they have a routine schedule that can always be met, just like, I was going to say Amtrak, but that's also not very routine most of the time. But like buying a bus ticket or something, we're going to be a long way away from that.
Well, I agree, and I think you need a spacecraft that was on the scale of let's put it this way. When Boeing introduced the 747, that pretty much changed the entire commercial airline market. It changed it from jet setting that, you know, only a few could really afford to something that everybody could afford. And jet setting, the new jet setting really that took place was people with their private jets. So I think you need something on the same scale of, you know, a spacecraft side to create the economics in order to at least get them down, maybe not to a couple hundred dollars or a couple thousand dollars tickets, but something that's, you know, certainly below tens of millions of dollars.
Well, we're a long ways away from any of it at the moment.
Well,
but you know, if Bigelow can get something that's commercial transportation to be able to put his space stations up there, and they work. Remember, we don't know that they work. They, you know, his scale models work when they launched them on the small Russian rocket many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. But he has yet to deploy an operational space station.
Well, he still had the modules he put in orbit are still there, and know the beam is going to be launched
pretty close
this
yeah,
year as well.
Later this year, and that'll tell a lot. But he needs to have a launch service for his operational stations, and they need to be, you know, proven out, whatever it will take to do that. And then he needs a ride for people to go up there, and mm-hmm. and so. I think he's making progress, but he's kind of dependent upon everybody else. It's horrible to be so dependent, right?
Well, I mean, mean, that's kind of the nature of the beast. I mean, space is a whole different creature in itself, just because of the means to get there and the means to stay up there. Excuse me, and it's a whole new ball game. It's really a whole new ball game, and we haven't really learned how to play the game to the economic scale where it can really be, you know, quote, affordable, and to really develop a new space economy in the sense.
Long ways away, I think.
I think so too, but you know, I think we can do it. I think it can be done. It's just a matter of we gotta be realistic about it.
I think we will be barring some unforeseen horrific event. I would say within 20 years we will be firmly established on our way to building a commercial space economy. Now I can't really tell you what it's going to look like, but I think we'll be on our way. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any even naysayers will be able to say we're not doing that.
Well, exactly, and I think you're right in saying you're not sure what it's going to look like, because I don't think anybody really knows what it's going to look like. It's something that's going to materialize as we go forward in a lot of trial and error. It'll definitely materialize and become more be less innocuous and become more solid, less like it's more like Jell-O right now. Nobody can really pin it to a tree and say this is what it's going to look like.
Anything happening on space law front for 2015?
I haven't really seen a lot. You know, there's some other themes that I've really been, you know, kind of thinking on. You know, the space debris issues and stuff like that. That's a huge one. And actually, this ARM mission is you know, this modified ARM mission is a little bit interesting because, you know, I'm not all excited. I'm not all jumping up and down because of, quote, this is the path to Mars. That's just a cut and paste line that they had to put in there to, you know, as part of the package. But some of the mission milestones are very interesting, especially the gravity tractor demonstration to see if that technique can work for diverting a future asteroid that may be heading towards the planet.
Why are they scaling it back to a boulder instead of an asteroid? Are they just playing word games with us?
I couldn't tell you. I don't have the inside track, and I really haven't talked to some of the players in it.
Well, I'm working on a guest who's working on the project, and he does have the inside track, and I told him if he comes on the show, and I hope he does, he'll be the only one to talk positively about the ARM on the show.
Yeah. Actually, I'm pretty excited about it. I'm pretty enthusiastic about it, because I think if you can get past this is the pathway to Mars, you know, crud, whatever you want to call it, you know, the snow they're trying to push off on it, and look at what they're trying to do. They have several milestones that they're going to try to accomplish while they're there, including landing on it, retrieving a boulder, and taking a boulder off it and taking off again. But the thing that really caught my eye was the gravity tractor demonstration, because it's interesting. The International Institute of Space Law just had a moot court competition on, and it's basically a mock trial competition based on space law issues, and really the issue on this one was basically that one of the litigants tried to use a gravity tractor technique on an asteroid, but the asteroid hit the Earth anyways and caused damage to the other party's state, and they were trying to determine who was liable or not. And so I thought that was pretty. The timing of that was pretty interesting. And actually, I graded some when I was talking with Marsha last a couple weeks ago. I mentioned having fun grading the briefs. Well, that's what we were grading briefs for. We were judges to grade the briefs for that particular competition.
My show tomorrow. You haven't seen the newsletters yet, and damn it, I can't. Let's see if I can get to the guy's book. He's in England. Okay, so this is with Professor Tony Milligan. And he is an ethics professor in a philosophy department at a university in the UK, and I forget the name of the university, but Milligan is M-I-L-L-I-G-A-N. And his book is, I'm leaning over hard to see it at the other end of the room, Nobody Owns the Moon, and he's speaking out about the risk of exploitation by the commercial side of the industry. I'm kind of loosely putting words into the book and that's not ethical. So he's going to be the guest today, and the book is, this is not a book that that I've enjoyed reading in the sense that, I really like the content. But it is provocative, it is challenging, and he sees problems with what we talk about all the time.
Well, I think, I haven't heard of him, and I haven't heard about that, and I think I'm going to have to tune into the show tomorrow and listen and maybe even call in. But that's a huge thing. The legal issues are always a part of it. In fact, I remember that the Mars One article Chris Newman and I published in the Space Review a couple weeks ago. As soon as it was published, I got an email from Susan Martin. Remember Susan Martin from the Mars Society?
Yeah, she's been on the show.
Yeah, she sent me an email thanking me for finally coming out, speaking out about the legal issues surrounding Mars One, or even a Mars journey in general. She said, because that's one big thing that the people in the Mars Society just, and this is not just the Mars side, but all over, they just don't want to listen to the legal end of it or the ethical end of it.
Well, I don't know that this is more legal than caged in a what's ethical. Is it ethical to exploit the moon?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to pull it up on Amazon, and I thought I did get it on Amazon, but maybe it's only on the UK Amazon. I don't know. It's not showing up for me as I'm trying to do it now. Nobody owns the moon. But, by Tony Milligan. The Ethics of Space Exploitation book was published in January of this year. It is on American's Amazon. And let me see if I can, I should have had the book here at the table. Space exploration and off-world commercial activity engaged the attention of both enthusiasts and skeptics. Despite differing opinions, what does seem clear is that such activity has increased and is set to expand further and dramatically so during the present century. This book explores some of the ethical issues of the emerging space frontier and evaluates prospects for the medium-range frontier. Can terraforming of other worlds succeed? Would it be defensible? Should there be limits to mining in space? Do lifeless planets have an integrity that ought to be respected? Could indigenous microbacteria have intrinsic value? Do we have a duty to extend human life? The ethics of sending generation ships on interstellar journeys and the risk associated with sending other worlds with rudimentary forms of life are also discussed. As exploration is as much about humanity as it is about space, the book concludes with a study of the connection between the sharing of a home planet and the membership of a single moral community. So I'm assuming it's going to be pretty interesting discussion.
Yeah, I'll have to make sure and tune in.
University of Hertfordshire.
Okay.
I apologize to our British listeners. I simply don't know very much about that. And Professor Milligan specializes in the subject of ethics. He wrote here's his short biography. Anyone who reads Beyond Animal Rights 2010 will recognize that my sympathies are very much with animals, but I also hold that we need a rich moral vocabulary. One that doesn't, this is his bio, by the way, that doesn't reduce everything down to one big concept such as rights or consequences or even goodness. We need lots of moral concepts to do lots of different jobs. My second book, Love, 2011, draws upon this same background assumption. As humans, we need to see ourselves not just as the barriers of rights or as rational agents, but as beings who are lovable. An appreciation of this is central to our grasp of our own worth. The Love book is out in the autumn, and in its final chapter, I return to the question of what is at stake in our love for the non-human, for other creatures, for places, and for nature. Currently, I'm writing a book on civil disobedience for the continuum. My feeling is that we need a new account of civil disobedience, one that is not modeled around the protest of decades ago, but will. And it goes on. I don't need to keep reading it. But that's actually his bio, although that doesn't really tell you very much about the guy. It just tells you, I guess, you can infer about him and his stuff. But should be interesting, and I think now that you will probably be able to grasp what he says about lunar exploitation and ethics in developing space and doing things like terraforming, assuming we could even do that. There are no comments, by the way, yet on the Amazon site.
The bottom line is, whether you think he's right, it'll be interesting to see what he has to say, but whether you think he's right or wrong, everybody has their right to their opinion, and getting those opinions out is important.
I thought only I had my right. I had the right for an opinion, right? Isn't that the way it works with space cadets?
Well, it is until you confront them and let them know otherwise. But sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But
yeah, no, he has no customer reviews yet on Amazon, so I can't read you any reviews. But it should be a very interesting discussion. I'm looking forward to it, and have really had good email exchanges with him.
Well, it sounds like it will be. I'll have to see if I can tune for that tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, so it's 5 o'clock to 6:30 your time.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'll keep that in mind.
Anything else?
The only thing else I would say is the political end of it back on the 17th. One of the House committees had a hearing on assured access to space. They grilled Tory Bruno and Gwen Chautel pretty good. And then afterwards brought up their group of experts, government experts, including General Hyten from U.S. Stratcom, to talk about, the big issue was, whether or not ULA should be allowed to purchase 14 additional more RD-180 engines, which is more than what the current Defense Authorization Act allows. And that was in fact, I'll send you a link. You can watch it on YouTube. It's about 2 hours. I'll send you a link if you want to post it on Flight or anything. Very interesting. Very interesting. But what both groups had to say during that committee hearing, it all came down to the bottom that, if ULA isn't allowed to purchase those additional RD-180s, they can't throw up anything against the Falcon 9. And it's funny, the chair of that committee basically backed Gwen Chautel right down. And he said ULA cannot put up another rocket, medium class rocket, that means you have monopoly in this category. And she wouldn't say the monopoly word, but her response is basically said, okay, that basically tells us a monopoly for those years that they don't have that medium class rocket if they don't allow those extra RD-180s to be purchased. Very good. It's a couple hours, but it was, well, I watch it because I got to keep abreast of what's going on, but it's very interesting, some of the comments on there, especially from the group of experts who really gave a reality check at the, of what's really going on with this.
What did they say the reality check was? Did it support what Tony said?
The reality check from the group of experts is that, basically, what it all boiled down to the end, the best option is the best option for a new engine. The fact that a new engine is going to take about 4 to 5 years to get lit up, you actually get certified. But not only that, you need a new launcher for it. They really came down at the end to saying the best option is to get build the RD-180 here in the United States. And it's like oh my God, we just came full circle. I like the committee chairman. He wasn't very versed. He wasn't a super expert on space. He admitted that, and he asked good questions, though, and that really impressed me a lot.
Who was the committee chairman?
I can't remember his name right off the top of my head, but he's a guy from the South. Smart guy. Very smart guy. And I was really I was impressed because he asked the right questions, and he didn't, he wasn't throwing any softballs.
Send me the link, okay?
I will send you the link to the YouTube, and it's on YouTube right now, so you can, it's excellent. I would really recommend sitting down and watching it.
All right. Take care, Michael. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, bye.
Listeners, Michael's off the line, and that does open up our toll-free line here, 1-866-687-7223. I do hope a lot of you can tune in tomorrow for Tony Milligan's show on the moon and exploiting the moon and the ethics of doing a lot of things that we talk about and support on the space show. Go to Amazon and look him up. He has a whole page. And again, the title of the book is Nobody Owns the Moon. And I know Monday is often a hard show for many of you to listen to. It's 2 p.m. California time. A lot of you will be at work, but 5 p.m. on the East Coast, so you may be in a subway or something. But if you can tune in and participate in this show, and I'm assuming most of my listeners will not be in very much agreement with what he has to say, but, you know, just ideas are fair game. You know, we don't need to be attacking and rude to the people. As Michael said, he's certainly welcome to his own ideas and his discussions. And I think it'll be a fascinating discussion. I do have the book. I have been reading it, and I do know what we're in store for. And, well, we'll just leave it at that. Hopefully many of you can listen. And I of course, will archive it as soon as possible. We have another caller on the line. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you?
Hi, this is Doug Tata.
Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, I just wanted to reply to a couple things that in your discussion with Michael Listener. Regarding the modified ARM, you ask, you know, why just a boulder? And I think Michael did touch on it. I think the gravity tractor is probably, you know, aspect of it. Planetary defense is probably the main thing that caused them to go that direction. And what's interesting is you ask, why is it just a small boulder instead of a larger asteroid? I think that the size of the asteroid might be irrelevant when it comes to taking a drilling a sample. It doesn't really matter the size of it. If it's small, if it's large, you get a sample of it either way. And so I don't think the size really makes a difference. Also, I think an argument is if it's brought back to a DRO, a distant retrograde orbit around the moon, that it could be available for asteroid mining companies to sort of work with in its, shall we call it the native environment, sort of zero-G environment. And it may be that the size of it may not be particularly relevant for demonstration purpose either. In other words, does it really make a difference whether you're processing, 100 kilograms versus 1,000 kilograms? If you prove it at 100 kilograms, perhaps that's sufficient. But what I would wonder is whether there's another reason for going for this modified ARM approach, and that is if you're going and getting a small boulder off a larger asteroid, it may be that it would actually take less ion propellant to do that. And I don't know if it would be easier to reach. In other words, if it increases your scope of possibilities of targets to go after. I don't know, but I would be interested to see if anybody else has ideas on that. So that's my thinking about that.
I don't know very much about it, but I do know the ARM is really an unpopular mission, and most of what I read is it's not going to ever get funded, and it's not going to ever get done. And I would assume that this is some kind of a let's punt and run fallback position for them to try to do something comparable or similar for a much lower cost and keep their dream of some kind of ARM mission alive. I mean, that's what my initial take on it is. But if I get this guy from NASA on, who is actually working with it, he sent me a whole page of how cool this is with all the what they're going to do, which still doesn't, none of it's very exciting, and I don't think it'll still be exciting to most people. But I do think it's kind of a let's see how we can save the mission effort by NASA, and then how can we spin it so that it doesn't come off that way. That's my take on it. But listen, I'm so far down the totem pole on inside information,
right,
and knowledge is not even funny.
See, my perspective is that they recognize that their first ARM concept was not, a lot of people were not excited about it. And so I think they're trying to enhance the value of it by saying it has an additional planetary defense dimension to it if they do it the second way, in that by doing the gravity tractor demonstration, they can illustrate how they could divert a larger, more threatening asteroid by demonstrating this gravity tractor approach.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if even this flies, but maybe this will be more affordable, and their spin will make it go down better, and they'll have more support for it.
Yes. I think they're trying. My guess is probably the answer is still no. that's just a guess. Let me just mention that I read Michael Listener's article about the sort of the legal and ethical aspects of Mars One, and frankly, I have never been supportive or impressed by Mars One, and so I'm sort of glad to see, you know, their feet being held to the fire. But I thought that Listener's article really opened up some really new territory, some interesting dimensions that, frankly, I have not heard discussed about Mars One. Have you, David?
No, I mean, when I told Michael and his co-author, because they'd sent it to me ahead of time, that they didn't focus on the usual things that are said about Mars One at all, and including a lot of the stuff that the MIT students, you know, criticized for, and a lot of the human factors and other things like that. But they did bring up some interesting other kinds of issues that I don't think most of us have ever thought about, because we don't get past the human spaceflight things, the medical needs, and the life support and the engineering stuff. So I have not heard his issues that he talked about in that article talked about by anyone else. I told him both that was the really cool part of the article, is that it raised a whole bunch of issues that none of us had ever considered.
Yeah.
But didn't really address the usual customers and suspects on long-duration spaceflight.
But in a sense, I mean, those other issues have already been addressed. So I felt like this is a valuable contribution to the discussion.
Yeah, so I don't know how many people saw it, and I don't know if Michael and his author, co-author, are getting private emails and comments for it or anything. I don't know how it's going down as a result of what they wrote. I don't know. I should have asked him if he had heard from anyone from Mars One specifically, but I forgot to ask him that when he called. If he's still listening, maybe he can call back or email us and tell us. I'm wondering if Boss or somebody called him. I will use some of what he said in that article when Sonia is on the show on the 12th of April. Wasn't that the name of a song, the 12th of April or something like that, with John Mathis? It was back before your time, I guess. I bet that they haven't thought about some of those issues either, unless Michael wants to call in and talk to her, and then I'll let Michael bring them up. But I thought it was a good article. Listeners, it's on the Space Review, I think it's last week. So it's Michael Listener and his co-author, but if you can find it just by Michael Listener, and I would urge you to read their article.
Yeah.
What do you think of canceling Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and Opportunity, although your focus is more on the moon?
I think I support both. I support canceling both. It's not a real strongly held position. My feeling is Opportunity, I think there has been a diminishing returns in terms of science returns for quite a long time. And I feel like that it may have served its usefulness. Maybe it ended in terms of really new science. I think maybe it's well past that point. LRO, I don't know what new science it's coming up with at this point in time. I'm less certain about that.
Well, they need it to complete a certain kind of mapping, which is not going to be completed if they cancel it. And so they claim, and Paul Spoudis was one of the main contributors to why they shouldn't be canceling this. And I forget what kind of mapping they're doing, and I don't have the article in front of me for the show, but I read a summary of it on Yahoo News, and they really want to complete this different kind of mapping, and if they cancel it, they won't complete it, and then that mapping is really useful for a lot of different purposes for the moon.
I'm totally open to that. I mean, it seems so being halfway done developing a map and then stopping, it doesn't sit right. I guess what I would question is for scientific purposes, is getting a sample. You know, oftentimes we do studies in which we do a sample instead of a complete census, and yet you can gather a lot of, you can estimate what the rest of the census would have been based upon a good sized sample. But there could be specific locations which are unique and need to be imaged in this way that if you don't finish it, you don't have that information. So I just don't have enough information to really say for sure.
Here, I've got the article. So actually it wasn't on Yahoo News where that was an article. I saw something else. This is on theexaminer.com, and it's a summary by Mark Whittington of some of the other articles. And let me tell you what kind of mapping. Man, I can't use Internet Explorer anymore. It's just such a piggy bloated. Google Chrome is so much faster. Okay. Let's see. So this was reported in space.com yesterday. I mean on Friday. And where the hell is the type of mapping that they want to continue to do? Let's see if I can find it real quickly.
While you're looking at it, I wanted to sort of respond to a comment made earlier in the show in regards to space tourism.
Hold on. A global... Okay. Hi, this is Spudis talking. If we can continue to operate LRO for the next few years, we may eventually obtain a global high-resolution map of the entire moon, Spudis said. This data set will be used for decades to come and will allow the identification of new sites for exploration, utilization, and eventually habitation. And it's a long article, but it goes on and on and on. But so that's what I was referencing when they said they really need it to continue a kind of mapping. So it's a global high-resolution map of the entire moon, and he said they need it running for the next few years. That's as close to a timetable as we get.
Okay.
Do you subscribe to Whittington's articles on the Examiner in Houston? Because that's where
I do, and frankly, I'm just having increasing appreciation for what he does. I mean, that's becoming a major source of space news for me.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder how these guys have all this time to find all this stuff. But that's what they were talking about. So I don't know. You know, I'm a big fan of Paul's, so I tend to think he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, it's an opportunity cost thing, and that is with the money, if they were to shut it down. I'm feeling it's probably not a great deal amount of money, but then what could that money be put to, and what would be the benefit from that? You know, I just don't know.
I don't either. Maybe flying carpets or something. I don't know. What was your other comment?
Yeah, but back to space tourism. Michael made a statement. You know, he basically said, "I refuse to believe it until I see it." And as a form of argument, I find that rather frustrating because, you know, fortunately, not everybody in the world holds that view. Otherwise, we wouldn't have truly new things being. You know, people wouldn't push forward with truly new things. Investors would invest in truly new things, and it's just for me, it's a frustrating argument because it means sort of blinding yourself to looking at the factors which would predict if something's going to be successful. You just sort of wipe that aside and say, you know, I refuse to look at the indications of success in the future. I'm just going to wait until I actually see it come to reality. And everybody else who makes progress doesn't have that view. They're actually imagining the future, looking at it and seeing if it's likely or not, if it's probable, and then moving forward based upon that. So I don't know. It's I just want to express my frustration about that. And I know, David, you've expressed a sentiment many times before, sort of this Missouri state motto sort of thing.
Show me.
Yeah, the show me state, and that's fine, but it's fine if you're really conservative. Like if you're an investor and you say, I don't want to invest in truly new stuff. I only want to invest in stuff that I know I can get a return, and that's proven stuff. Well, somebody's got to be on the cutting edge. Somebody's got to open the frontier, and you can't do that by saying, I'm going to wait until I'm shown. That's my view.
Michael did respond to your Mars One comments.
Okay.
So he said and my comments too. After the article was published, Mars One refollowed me on Twitter as they had unfollowed me a month before. I also had some back and forth with a colleague of mine who is their legal advisor about Mars One. She did not directly address what was raised in our article. Chris Newman, that's his co-author and also a guest on the Space Show, was invited to speak on BBC Radio that was broadcast last Sunday concerning the ethics of Mars One. Now, that'd be interesting. I wonder what Chris had to say. And Chris may be doing a show on the ethics of Mars One. I might consider that with you, so email me if you're listening. Other than that, about 80 comments on the Space Review so far, most of them from the usual suspects, ranging from positive to you're nuts. And as I said, Michael, Sonia will be on, and she's one of the 100 selected, will be on April 12th. I believe that is a Sunday. I hope you do call in and talk to her. But that's his feedback so far, and he's still alive, so nobody's put out a hit on him yet.
In my opinion, the sooner Mars One dies, the better. I think it's a poor idea from the get go.
Well, it's not going to die anytime soon. Are you kidding? Boss is a master at PR, and as long as you keep it going.
It seems like people are beginning to pile on now, and frankly, I think they deserve it.
Well, that's of course they deserve it, but that's neither here nor there, because he will spin his way out of it, and he will answer. And when Sonia was on this really disgusting cable show that I saw once and only once because Dwayne Day told me that she was on it and I'd get an idea of what she was like with the media. So this is something called Late Night or something. It's on the Comedy Central station. I forget what it's, Nightly something. I don't know what it is. But it was really, really horrible. And they had a panel of people that were asking her questions. And this was the most frivolous, stupid waste of pixels on my TV or airway or electricity that, you know. And I mean, she was a good sport to go along with it, so I have to hand it to her. She's a very good looking young lady, and she can flow with it and keep herself going, and she seems to have a good sense of humor, and she'll be a really truly great space show guest. I'm really looking forward to that. She really can handle herself, and my hunch is she'll quit being a Democratic Party operative and she'll get a media gig after Mars One finally. No, I'm dead serious. She absolutely will get some kind of an incredible media gig, because she really was good on that show, as lousy and disgusting as that show was. But she can respond and answer. There was only one serious question to ask her, and that was about the MIT thing. And she didn't miss a beat. That's already been debunked. And Mars One has already answered, and the reason it's debunked is because they were basing all of their technology analysis on the International Space Station, but we're not using International Space Station, hardware or anything, so none of that is relevant. So it's all been debunked. Of course, none of that is true, because the Mars One website says that they're using off-the-shelf technology and ISS system, which is why the MIT guys looked at the ISS systems and said they don't work on going to Mars, and you're going to have oxygen poisoning and this and that and the other. And for Sonia to spin it that it's been debunked is just a flat-out lie. She's been in politics too long. But, boy, she didn't miss a beat. She was right on it. And that was the only serious question she got on the whole show. But I don't know.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to that show, and I'm glad you're bringing her on.
Well, I hope she doesn't back out. I hope she stays on.
Yeah, but I remember, for example, I remember being at ISDC, and Boss Lonsdorf was given a real prominent speaking spot, and I was sort of like rolling my eyes because I said, I think this is really fantasy, and yet he was getting a lot of press. And
unbelievable press. Unbelievable.
Yeah. But I think initially there was this whole, oh, wow, people would really be willing to go one way. And it's almost as though the risks make it more attractive, as opposed to the opposite of what it should be. And that is, the more risky it is, the less likely we should do it.
But remember, even Alan Stern jumped on the bandwagon, and well, we did an Uwingu show, remember? And their yeah. Uwingu crater naming map of Mars was to go on their 2017 or 2018 flight. Well, Boss, when he finally answered the MIT group, said that that mission is delayed till 2020 or something like that. Well, so I guess when they do that mission, which, in, of course, in my opinion, they will never do that mission, the map will go then. But even Alan joined, you know, with them for getting that map to Mars.
Yeah, well, I have my opinions about Uwingu.
Well, that's another story, but
right.
I'm just, you know, Boss gets a lot of support, and he, you know, that I've interviewed him three times, I think, and he's incredibly polite. He's cordial. He can answer on the, he can flip and move on a dime. He can move really quickly. He's fluent. He's a very smart guy, and he is a master at PR, one of the best I've ever come across.
I predict it's going to fade away.
Well, at some point, it either has to, as they say, get off the pot or fade away. I mean, you know, you can't keep going on forever and ever and ever, although some space kind of things do that. But no, I think at some point he will have to produce something, either like do his Phoenix-like mission or raise enough money and or maybe get another TV contract. You know, his TV contract fell apart for his reality
right.
TV show. So he's going to have to produce something. He can't just keep pontificating with excuses forever and a day.
But that is true. But up to this point, I don't think there's been as much piling on as there has been recently. So I'm thinking that's going to have an effect.
No, I think when he named those 100 people and then this guy published that thing that we've all been talking about, and I forget his name, but the NASA engineer who talked about how they interviewed him and all of this and, you know, the other kind of stuff, I think that just opened the door for a free-for-all for him.
Yeah. I think the MIT thing, it was sort of a confluence of things.
So I don't know. I think it will ultimately fade away, but listen, maybe the next group that comes around will build on Mars One and do it much better. And, you know, eventually it'll get done.
I think there could be a case made for a lunar equivalent of that. You know, I think it would be a lot more realistic.
Yeah, but I don't think you'd want the Mars One people doing it because they turn it into a joke, too.
No. Anyhow.
Anything else?
No, I think. Well, I was going to argue against NPR, but let me just list, you know, give other people a chance, and if there's any time, maybe I could call in about that.
You want to promote your track at Space Access?
Oh, yes. Oh, this is rather exciting. Space Access coming up at the end of this month. Let's see, the 30th of April to the 2nd of May. And I've been given a few hours to organize a track, and it's called COTS 2, Return to the Moon. And we're lining up a really excellent set of speakers that I'm really very excited about. And I can mention two of them. Some of them were just absolutely confirming. But Jeff Grayson and Dave Mastin are going to be speaking in that track, and I will too. And then we have, I think, a prominent Mars advocate, and then a prominent, looks like an astronaut advocate, if that's the right term. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. And do you know what day you're going to be on yet?
It looks like Friday. Friday probably morning or late or early afternoon.
Okay. Well, you've got
and,
time. You'll update us, I'm sure.
Sure. We got a month. Something that wasn't pointed out was it's really one of the least expensive space conferences that you could go to. David, do you recall how much it is? I think it's 130, somewhere about there.
I was going to say about 125 or something like that.
Yeah, but that's a really good price.
So, and it's in Phoenix, which is one of my favorite places, so it's... unfortunately, you miss spring training, but other than that, it's a great place to be.
And it's a really one of the better networking opportunities, in my opinion. So just like to encourage my fellow space show listeners to join us there.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Listeners, I'm going to take a break, but I got an email from Kelly, which I'll read real quickly. The irony of the current situation with the Atlas V's effective monopoly is that it came about as a cost reduction effort. Launch costs are almost totally fixed cost, R&D, physical, and corporate overhead, etc., divided by the number of flights. So Washington pushed for consolidation, and just like with military procurement in general, that pushed towards single providers and whipped out competitors. Add in the push to use the good low-cost RD-180, and here we are. Expect similar issues with lots of other military and government contracts where the sole surviving provider stumbles or a common fault is found, and say half our fighters are grounded due to hacked flight control software. More fun to come. Kelly, and we're going to break. I know somebody's calling us, and they're going to have to wait because we're beyond the halfway point. So listeners, will be back in 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere. This is Open Lines Sunday on The Space Show. Stay tuned.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Open Lines program on Sunday, and all of your calls are welcome. First-time callers are welcome. 1-866-687-7223. We should have a caller on hold with us. Caller, are you there, please?
Yes. This is Chris from Cheyenne.
Chris, sorry I kept you waiting during the break.
Oh, that's okay. I expected it.
What's up?
Yeah, I was calling about your earlier conversation about legal issues in space, you know, treaty issues, you know, homesteading rights, and you know, stuff like Greens who are worried about you know, human, you know, lunar regolith having human rights, or you know, other stuff.
So the ethics show tomorrow.
Oh dear Lord!
Right, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, there's, you know, an American or a European entrepreneur has all sorts of legal roadblocks thrown in his face, mostly through UN treaties and the like, and you know, needing permission from local, you know, from the U.S. government to do anything outside of the atmosphere. Entrepreneurs and or even entire countries such as Russia or China are just going to ignore all that. You know, anybody operating under a Russian flag is going to have their property rights on the moon defended by the Russian government or the Chinese government. if they get to the moon and start exploiting, say, water resources or thorium resources, you know, the Russian or the Chinese government will just blandly assure the, you know, the lawyers and the Greens that all the UN treaties are being properly followed, and yet they'll privately defend their asserted homestead rights. You know, if some private entrepreneur wants to put an NTR in orbit or a new reactor on the moon, the Russians or the Chinese, if they were operating under their cover, would just quietly put it up there and then announce it as a fiat accompli afterwards. And then blandly assure the UN bureaucrats, the Greens, that this is legal and that all precautions were followed. You know, they'll just do it. In fact, these two governments probably see all these UN treaties as a weapon to use on competition. You know, they won't hesitate to throw lawyers at competitors that are operating outside of their flags in order to prevent them from getting anything done. You know, all this business with needing to worry about, you know, legal problems for putting, say, an NTR in orbit or in planetary space or a nuke reactor on the moon, that won't stop the Chinese or the Russians or any companies operating under them from just doing it.
So you think we should do the same thing?
Personally, yeah. I'd like to see the UN building evacuated and that been pushed into Turtle Bay, but I guess I'm just one of those nasty conservative radicals.
That's right. Part of the right-wing conspiracy, right?
I'm pretty much a right-wing conspirator. I just don't see any good coming from the UN, and this is just another example. It's going to be used as a shackle to prevent any Western efforts in space. And it's not going to affect the Russians or the Chinese at all. We'll just go ahead and do it.
A few weeks ago, Anatoly Zak was on the Full Space Show, and I asked him if there were pressures and movements in Russia similar to the United States against nuclear this and this technology and that technology. He said it's not as active as it is in the United States, but the forces are still there, and they do pressure their government. So
they put pressure on them, but the Russian and Chinese governments are more than capable of just ignoring it.
I think that's what he's saying. They're more likely to ignore it than our governments and our Congress.
Yeah, if there's going to be any controversy, they'll just keep their mouths shut about what they're doing.
So, then maybe that's how we'll get nuclear propulsion in space.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. If I wanted to get serious into the space business, it's starting to look like I'll have to learn either Russian or Mandarin.
Well, maybe Michael, the ever-watchful attorney, and others will call in and...
What are they going to do, throw a writ at the Russians or the Chinese government? They'll just smile and say, oh, yes, this is very important. We'll attend to it immediately, and then do whatever they please.
Well, I don't know. Maybe Boehner will hold a committee hearing. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that'll have Roscosmos just quivering in their boots.
Kind of like some of these other people are quivering in their boots when they get a subpoena that they ignore from Congress, right?
Well, yeah, if you're politically corrected, you can pretty much get away with anything. If you're not, well, too bad. You know, if it's unfortunate that you'd have to consider renunciation and going to a different country to get anything serious done. You know, it's just very irritating to me.
Do you think that this is likely to change in the near future?
It's possible to change, but I'm not sure if folks who are interested in changing this have the clout to do it right now.
Well, I don't think most people see a big reason to be alarmed about anything with space. So maybe if there was some reason to motivate people to being concerned about space, you might see more action than you would see now, but most people are oblivious to space to begin with, and it's not a burning issue affecting them in one way or another.
Well, other folks aren't, so there you go.
I mean, you know, the space cadets keep the torch going, but you know, talk to people in the here. I went to lunch the other day with a group of people. I donated my services to a local Rotary Club, and they auctioned me off for a luncheon to talk about space. So they actually got two different parties to subscribe to two different lunches. I'm actually surprised that there was that much interest.
Yeah, the American public likes the idea of space exploration, and they'd be entirely in favor of, say, somebody putting up an NTR to, you know, to begin the process of a manned mission to Mars. But unfortunately, they don't have as much of a voice as a bunch of Luddites who are frightened of the very notion of putting, you know, nuclear materials in orbit.
Well, this is the interesting thing. Now, again, these people bid for the Rotary Club on a luncheon on space, so obviously they have an interest. And toward the end of this two-hour luncheon, and they're all interested in space and different parts of space, and their questions and their discussion was pretty decent, and you know, no complaints on my part. I said, what would all of you think? And then I went around the table, if we had an opportunity to increase the NASA budget from one half of 1%, which is where it is today, $18 billion, to 1%, which would be roughly $35 or $36 billion. Would you support that? So the first guy says, is it my money? And I said, yeah, of course it's your money. Where else does the government get money? It takes money from the citizens through taxes and regulations and fees. And he says, well, then no, I'm not supporting that. I don't want my money to do anything like that. I'd rather them fill the potholes in San Francisco. Okay, that's person number one. Person number two, no, I don't support that. We have too many other projects and too many other deserving people that need money here on Earth, and we really don't need to fund space any more than what we're funding it. Now, if the private sector wants to go do all of this stuff on its own and wants to spend money and build infrastructure and some of the stuff you're talking about, I don't care about that, but we should not be paying anything more from the government. So I went around the table, and the response from everybody was 100% the same. And again, these are people who bid on a Rotary Club luncheon, you know, for gift purposes. I don't know what they bid and what my gift was worth, because it's not a 501c3, so I can't deduct my services or anything. And they all have an interest in space, but when it comes to let's increase the budget, let's do something different, zero, zilch, nada, nothing.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. You know, nobody wants to see more money come out of their own wallets.
Well, but it's coming out of their wallets anyway. It's just how are you using the money?
Yeah, it's going to be spent on something. But, you know, and everybody, of course, is in favor of, you know, of private efforts in space, but nobody seems to realize just how many roadblocks the government puts in front of this. You know, the United States has got an amazingly complicated bureaucracy.
Yeah, and I mean, I was actually surprised that nobody wanted to see an increase in NASA, given the way the conversation had been going. I was kind of surprised at that, but
yeah,
that's the way it is. And didn't Walter Cronkite, he always said, and that's the way the world is today, August 5th.
Well, you know, if the interest isn't like there to spend the money, that, you know, people are dealing with inflation issues right now, and money is short. You know, they're not too happy to see any taxes go out of their wallets at this point.
Well, yeah, but it's already coming out of their wallets. If you read the tax collection notices that you see from time to time, they're at record highs for the country. We're all being bled to death with taxes and fees.
Yeah. You know, people, you know, this is almost, you know, typical of what even small governments do when they want, you know, when citizens vote against a tax increase, the first thing they attack are the
police
popular things like
police and emergency and fire and schools.
And police, Last thing they want to do is get rid of their cronies.
Oh, and their pork crap and all of their carpeting plush offices and this and that and the other. Well, what did
I don't see a way to change that quickly. In any case, this concerns me because our competitors in space are not going to follow all these Byzantine rules. They're just going to do stuff, and they won't hesitate to use these Byzantine rules and treaties to put their foot out and trip their competitors.
I wanted to ask you your impression, because you know much more about the nuclear industry than I do, about our guest on Friday.
Let me scroll back here.
Well, she was talking about nuclear, and then she got asked questions about why does Iran need centrifuges and thorium and other stuff. She had a background in nuclear weapons with Los Alamos, and she had a lot of interesting things to say about technology and innovation and doing it with private funds and not taking government money. But the latter part, maybe the last 20 minutes or so, 30 minutes, was about nuclear stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember the conversation.
And you sent in the ground vehicle flying over the water.
Caspian Sea Monster.
The Caspian Sea Monster, which I put
That was just a neat piece of technology. Not horribly useful for open ocean with a lot of wave height, but, it was just amazing. A wings and ground effect military aircraft with 8 jet engines up in front of the nose and, missile launchers down the back of it.
Did they actually build that thing?
They built 2 of them.
And what happened with it?
It's sitting ashore, just rusting right now.
That was a real cool video. I put the video in the archives of the show. I don't know if you saw that or not.
No, I hadn't looked, but yeah, that was probably the video that I'd seen earlier.
What did
you? They are making commercial versions of that.
Well,
two jet engines or turboprops on the tail.
Your thoughts on her nuclear comments?
There's a lot of stuff she can't talk about because, she was working for the government and she's undoubtedly under Secrecy Act restrictions. A lot of the problems with nuclear proliferation are that you just can't uninvent technology. Once somebody knows something is possible, 90% of the work is done.
Well, I found it interesting that she couldn't answer my question on the enrichment levels, and then
that was probably still classified information.
But it's on YouTube. It's on the
I know.
Net. You
yeah,
sent
I know.
You sent it to me.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, how foolish is that?
She doesn't have a choice. If she opens her mouth, she goes to prison.
She wouldn't go to prison. Look at all these people who open their mouth.
She might lose her security clearance, which means she's got to find another line of work.
Well, I found her to be a really interesting lady. I really enjoyed
talking
to her.
Yeah, I did too.
She's coming to San Francisco for some business. I don't know if there's a chance to meet her, but I'd certainly like to meet her. I found her really stimulating to talk to. But she didn't think much of our leadership negotiating with Iran, did she?
No, apparently they're they had a defector from the Iranian camp.
I saw that in the news.
Yeah, who just said that the U.S. team is negotiating for the Iranians. Period. They might as well just be wearing a GIMP suit and be on a leash.
Do you believe the guy? I mean, how do you know he's credible?
Yeah, I do. That's, I don't understand. It's like Putin said about, Obama. I'm not playing chess with Obama. It's like playing chess with a pigeon. He struts around on the board, knocks over the pieces, and defecates on the board and stands there thinking he's won. He's torqued off the Saudis, and the petrodollar is the only thing propping the dollar up. And now he's trying to cut a deal with the Iranians and supporting their military efforts in Iraq while being worried about their military efforts in Yemen. I mean, what on earth is he thinking?
I don't know, but Pamela was, I thought her comments, I was really dying of laughter under my breath for
Giving them the right to put centrifuges, you know, in deep and underground caverns, you know what they're going to do with them. They're going to make YouTube.
So, by the way, are these...
Drop a bomb on someone.
Are these big centrifuges or like desktop centrifuges? When they talk about thousands of them...
I have no clue what size they are.
Because they talk about, you know, 100,000 centrifuges or 300,000 centrifuges. How the hell could they have that many? I mean, that's...
I'm sure they're gas centrifuges. They're basically... objects that uranium hexafluoride gas is pumped through at pressure, and they're harvesting the heavier components out of the middle in order to change the concentration of U-235 to enrichment levels. I do know that they're run by Siemens chips and that the original purpose of Stuxnet was to specifically replicate and look for any computer that was inside the boundaries of Iran and controlling a Siemens chipset. If it found such a computer, it just ramped the centrifuge's pressure up and down repeatedly in the middle of the night until it broke.
We never did figure out definitively who did that virus, did we?
No, but we know who spilled the beans and let the Iranians know that we... That had been created and what it was doing.
Who
spilled
the beans?
White House.
They
bragged about it.
I don't remember that or was not aware of that.
Yeah, they spilled the beans. Originally, it was a big dark secret what Stuxnet was doing. You know, it was a very well-behaved virus. It did nothing unless it was inside the boundaries of Iran.
Interesting. What else can
and,
I...
Well, and now the Israelis are forced to use more strenuous measures. There's been a lot of mysterious deaths of trained nuclear academics and workers in Iran. All sorts of amazing accidents have been happening to them. I think somebody's figured out that it takes about a half generation to train a nuke tech.
Well... It's going to be interesting and...
very interesting times ahead.
And do you think the interesting times are also for the space industry, or are you looking...
I don't know. I do know that if things continue as they're going now, the U.S. and Europe may not be participating.
So I may have to call you Debbie Downer now instead of Michael.
Oh, I'm not... I'm sure that space... You know, space exploration will continue. I'm just irritated that I may have to learn Russian or Mandarin to participate.
Well, at least you can order food in a lot of good restaurants if
there
you learn
you
Mandarin.
Go.
Christopher, maybe you'll be shielded by some of this in Cheyenne.
Actually, I think Cheyenne's ground zero if it ever goes to nuclear war. F.E. Warren is next door.
Well... I don't know, but it's...
We'll see what happens.
We'll see, but Michael Listener now has competition for Debbie Downer's title. gloom and doom, Chris. So, listen,
yep.
Anything else you want to add today and cheer us
up?
No,
that's it. I was just whining about, you know, restrictions on Western space efforts, restrictions that no other country are going, you know,
well, they've all signed the Outer Space Treaty and all these things.
Oh, sure, they sign all sorts of stuff. That treaty is a wonderful weapon against the West. It'll have absolutely no effect on Russian or Chinese efforts.
So you think they just ignore it?
No, they'll smile and say that they're obeying it.
All right. Chris, I hope you have a good weekend.
I intend to.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you
Bye-bye.
For letting me call.
Bye. Okay, Michael Listener, you have competition for the Debbie Downer title. So we may have Debbie Downer and her daughter, or her son. What would Donald Downer? Anyway, I got two of them. Maybe we should look for the third one. Here comes another phone call. Will this be Debbie Downer number three? Let's see who's calling. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, David. It's Dwayne.
Hi, Dwayne. Are you going to be a Debbie Downer on us, too?
Oh, absolutely not. It just occurred to me, I think I've heard that guy call in twice to your show, and both times he's talked about renouncing his U.S. citizenship. So You know,
I didn't hear him say that specifically, but
well, he mentioned renunciation, which refers to renouncing your citizenship, and usually it means leaving the country. But there are people. I think there's a movement where people talk about renouncing their citizenship and then just kind of declaring themselves independent from the U.S. government.
I don't know, but when you read the stats on people who renounce citizenship, it's at an all-time high.
Well, good for them, you know. And if they think that they're going to get a better deal over in Russia, then, you know.
What's his name wants to come back?
More power to them. So, no, I'm not going to be a Debbie Downer. I actually have some information as opposed to opinions. So,
okay.
So you one of your earlier callers, the guy from the Moon, is it the Moon Society?
No. Oh, Doug called, but he's not from the Moon Society.
I'm sorry.
He's an independent researcher and
an
MD.
So he talked a bit about the ARM mission and why NASA selected it.
Uh-huh.
And so I actually have I heard the selecting official discuss why they went with that option as opposed to the baggy option for the mission. And there's actually so he did a phone call press availability when they announced the decision the other day.
To do a boulder, that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And so they originally had two options. There was the baggy option, which was to wrap a baggie around something, and then the other option is to go to a very large asteroid and then take a boulder off of it. And so they selected that second option instead of the baggy option. And so there's actually three reasons why that he gave for doing that. And the first one is that the technology, he thinks that technology has the greatest what they call extensibility, which means that they can extend the technology to do other things. So, for instance, once you develop those gripper arms and that capability, maybe you can use something like that on the moon. You can use it in free space. You could use it maybe on Mars or on Phobos. But you've developed those arms and that capability, that technology, that has some other use. And it's the same for the high-powered solar electric propulsion systems. So that was the first reason, extensibility. The second reason was that they actually have there's a greater number of attempts that they can make to actually perform the mission using that technology as opposed to the baggy. I guess with the baggy, you kind of get one try, and then you're done. You can't do it again. If you screw it up, you're lost. But the way they've worked it out, they have up to five. They can make up to five attempts to actually recover something. So, suppose they go up to an asteroid and they go up to a certain boulder, and they extend the arms and try to grab it, and it doesn't work. They could then back off, fly to another place on the asteroid, and try again. And they can do that five times. So that was the second reason. And the third reason is, and this kind of gets into the difficult description of asteroid trajectories and all that, which is that there are actually the launch windows for asteroids are really pretty small. It's a very short period of time. And if you miss that launch window, suppose it's just a hurricane goes through or it's rainy and you have bad weather and you can't launch, you may have missed the opportunity to go to the asteroid. What they're planning on doing is going to larger asteroids that actually would give them larger, greater launch windows. So those are the three reasons they gave that they explained why they picked that option as opposed to the other one. Back in January, I was at a conference, at an AIAA conference, and there was somebody there from NASA who had actually worked on the ARM system, these extendable grippers. And one of the things he explained why he preferred that approach as opposed to the baggy approach is that for small objects that we have observed, small asteroids, they've been tracked optically. But when they're tracked really, you know, basically they're just a point of light, and it's a point of very dim light. They're tracked optically. And they have very low albedos, and what the scientists are doing is they're estimating the size of that rock based upon how much reflectivity, you know, how much light it's reflecting back. And there are big error bars in that. And so that we don't know, for instance, if that object is 5 meters in diameter or 10 meters in diameter. And the problem with using the baggy approach is that if you go there and you only have a baggy that'll take five, you know, a 5 meter object, and the object is much bigger than that, you're out of luck. So the baggy approach is very limited in what it can do, you know, in its range against the probability errors that are inherent in tracking objects in space.
Do you think this is going to make this mission have more support than it has?
Oh, no, no. And I don't think it's going to necessarily make the mission more likely to happen. I'm just saying this is why they picked one option as opposed to the other. Whether or not it goes ahead, that's a separate issue.
Do you think it's, they keep saying, you know, it's a pathway to Mars and all of that. Do you think it is a pathway to Mars?
There are technologies that would be developed to do this mission that would have some applicability to Mars. So that part of it is true. The question is this the way to develop the maximum number of technologies that you need in order to send people to Mars? And there are people who argue that it is not. So, for instance, the solar electric propulsion system that they want to develop is a higher power system. And that certainly has extensibility to Mars, you know. So that's a real argument. But as you know, there's a whole bunch of other technologies you need to send people to Mars. And the question is, okay, which ones are going to be developed fastest, and which ones have the longest lead times, and all that.
We should just look to Mars One for how to figure all that out.
So I'm going to have an article about Mars One in tomorrow's Space Review.
Can you give us a hint of what you're saying?
Yeah, so I heard you talking about it earlier, and you were talking about the bad publicity they got in the past month. That's no kidding. I was in the past couple of days. I was actually looking at a number of news articles about Mars One, and boy, they just got hammered. There's a couple of dozen articles across a whole bunch of different websites, and that, you know, the Washington Post chimed in, Gizmodo chimed in, the Guardian in the United Kingdom chimed in, the National Post in Canada. There were just a lot of negative articles, a lot of them repeating things, but they got a lot of negative publicity between about mid-February and late, you know, March 23rd or something like that. They also got some positive publicity about when they made their announcement of their 100 candidates. They got a lot of positive press about that. But so what I actually was looking at is people keep talking about how, you know, a lot of space enthusiasts say, well, they're never going to get to Mars, but they'll probably create a reality show. And what I wrote about is that they're probably not going to create a reality show either, because it turns out that there's a long history of proposed reality TV shows about space, and none of them have ever gotten onto the air. So I actually counted at least 9 of them, plus the Mars One one, the Mars One proposal, and that's over 15 years.
That does not bode well for them doing that, but I've never thought they could finance their program with a space reality TV show.
Well, I don't think they're ever going to get a space reality TV show to begin with, but yeah, you're right, because they need billions of dollars, and even if you take them at face value, and I don't believe their $6 billion estimate at all, but even if you were to accept that, where are they going to get $6 billion? That is a huge amount of money, even from investors. You know, forget donations, forget doing a Kickstarter campaign. If you're trying to get people who are going to put money into this because they expect to get money out, $6 billion is a lot of cash.
And it's probably insufficient anyway, so.
Right, right. Well, and so what I went into a little bit is, you know, just the practicalities of a reality TV show I don't think make any sense, because they've just slipped their launch date for their human mission to 2027. So that's 12 years from now. Now, suppose they sign a reality TV show deal tomorrow to get something on the air this summer, okay? Well, if it lasts for one season, that's still 11 years before the launch. You know, how do you connect up a television program now with an event that is over a decade away?
I don't know, but you know, I don't even think I'd be that interested in watching their reality TV show. I mean, that's another issue. Would you care to watch that thing?
Well, you know, you don't watch reality TV in general. I don't. So
right. So why would I watch this? I mean,
yeah,
maybe I tune it in for curiosity one or two times, but that would be about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think visually, there's a lot of interesting things you could do. You could put, you know, you get a group of attractive people who are your candidates, and then you put them in a spinning centrifuge, and then you have them do survival training, and then you have them fly in a high performance aircraft and do things like that. And you know, visually, that all could be interesting. The success of these programs always hinges upon how, you know, not just the production values, but how interesting are the people, how attractive are the people.
Now, you're the one who told me to watch that Comedy Central show, I forget the name of it, that Sonya was on. And do you think that's kind of typical of the general audience interest and question level and knowledge about going to Mars? Because that was beyond... It was so low quality. I don't even know.
Yeah, it was pretty bad, actually.
It was horrible.
Well, that show's still new, and they're still trying to figure out, you know, their format. It was actually pretty bad, and that was the.
But they didn't know anything about going to Mars, and
right.
So my question is: forget the show and the format. Is that pretty much the typical knowledge level of, say, a general audience in America?
Right. Yeah. But. Keep in mind that it's, you know, that kind of show, it has to be entertaining, it has to be funny, and so nobody's going to say, you know, tell me about the oxygen-nitrogen ratio in your spacecraft. You know, they're always going to ask the questions to get a laugh or to be entertaining. The best shows are good at being both informative and entertaining when it comes to that kind of stuff. That one wasn't. That was horrible.
Well,
if you
asked Sonya to tell you about the oxygen-nitrogen ratios in her spacesuit, I bet you she couldn't answer that question at all.
Right.
I mean, the only serious question she got was the one on the MIT thing, and as I said earlier, she blew it off and dismissed it, and her comments were not accurate.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment of that show, of her on that show, and what is likely to happen, which is that, so Mars One is going to fold at some point. It's going to fade away. They're going to have a harder and harder time getting any kind of operating funds, and then you won't hear about them anymore. They just won't issue press releases, because that happens to lots of, you know, I never read your dissertation, but I've heard you talk about it. There were all these companies back in the 90s, and then again, all these companies competing for the Ansari X Prize, and they all put out press releases, and they were, you know, they were getting noticed for a little while, and then they just fade away, and the people go on and do other things. So these things don't usually come apart. They just disappear. And Mars One is going to disappear after a few years. I agree with you. She's going to try and turn this into an opportunity to appear on TV and to be a you know, she's engaging. She was.
Oh, she's going to get a gig. Trust
yeah,
me, she's
yeah,
going to move way up. She handles herself with the media really, really well.
She did, and actually, she was one of the most interesting people on that panel there. So, more power
absolutely.
To her. It doesn't mean that Mars One is going to happen.
No. Yeah, that's for sure. What else? Anything else on your mind?
So I got one other thing, and then I'll get off the line. Which I heard you on the John Batchelor show the other night, and you had mentioned this super stripey rocket,
the Air Force thing. I saw your post on that.
Yeah. So Super Stripey is not really a commercial competitor for launching small satellites. What it is it's this kind of odd program. So DARPA years ago was feeding money into a series of rapid launch programs that they called there was Air Launch was one of them, and Quick Reach was analogous, and I don't know exactly what Quick Reach was, but essentially DARPA was putting money into was giving money to companies to develop the ability to do rapid space launch, and then those projects kind of came apart. And somehow, somebody in Congress managed to steer some of that money towards what became Super Stripey. And Super Stripey is associated with the Air Force's Operationally Responsive Space Program, ORS. And so the idea is not necessarily to have an inexpensive rocket, but to have something that could be launched relatively quickly with minimal preparation. And so if, you know, imagine a scenario where one of our satellites, it's a time of war or intense crisis or something, and one of our satellites is either shot down or stops operating, and we happen to have a small spare sitting on the ground that can do some of those capabilities. The idea is that you'd have this rocket sitting over in a warehouse near the launch site, and you could integrate the payload on top of the rocket and launch it within, say, a few days without a lot of preparation. And so that's where Super Stripey comes from. Honestly, it's not a terribly inspiring program. I learned about it back in May of 2013, and I went to a press conference that they were giving, and they were talking about how they were going to launch it in that November. And here we are, it's 2015, and they're talking about launching it in something like October or November of this year. So it's slipped by 2 years already. They apparently have had some performance problems in that. So it's not I think this is something that's going to go away once their sponsorship disappears.
The other question I asked Doug on the Bachelor show was, do you think the market for small satellite launch might be passing Launcher One by, given some delays, and now they're looking, you know, at being maybe testing something at the end of 2016. What are your thoughts on Launcher One?
So, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on this. I put you in touch with a guy by the name of Phil Smith.
Right.
Have you been able to contact him about being on your show?
No, wait a minute. I don't remember being put on. Phil Smith.
Okay.
I remember the guy with Hexagon, but that's a different Phil.
That's a different Phil, yeah. So Phil Smith, I'll resend.
I forgot all about that.
Yeah. So Phil is actually an analyst who covers the launch industry, and he deals with licensing of rockets and things like that. And he does market analysis. So he figures out how many payloads are likely to be launched over the next 5 years and of what types and, you know, who's going to sell them rockets and all that kind of stuff. And he does this, you get him on the show and you can ask him who he does it for and why he does it. But essentially he looks at the big markets. And Phil had recently told me that there was, that he had been looking at the really small satellite market. And there's something like, I think he calculated that over the next decade, there's something like almost 800 CubeSat-sized payloads that are going to be launched. But I think he said a lot of them are essentially going to go up on very few rockets. They're going to have, you know, one rocket is going to spit off 50 of these or something like that. But what he also noted is that there's going to be a requirement for replenishment. So once some of these companies establish their constellations, once they put up, you know, 50 satellites or whatever to do, you know, internet in the sky or broad remote sensing or whatever, there's going to be a requirement to launch one or two at a time to fill in for ones that fall out of orbit or break or whatever. And so I think there is a market for things like what Virgin One is trying to do. There are a number of companies that are out there that are trying to make that capability. I don't know how serious any of them are. And there is a problem with, as you know, there's a direct relationship between the size of a vehicle and the cost per pound. And that at the very low end, with really small rockets, it turns out they're very expensive for what you're able to put into orbit with them. And so the challenge for a lot of these companies is to drive down that cost so that instead of spending $17 million on a really small payload, they're now, you know, they're spending $5 or $6 million on the same payload. And you might remember SpaceX was originally going for that kind of market, actually. They were going for the very low end and with the Falcon 1 and then realized that that wasn't a great way to make money.
Absolutely. Well, resend the email so I can take action on it.
Yeah, I'll do that. But I think the good thing about having Phil is that he's somebody who actually looks at the markets and he can talk authoritatively about how many rockets are likely to be sold for what? What's going to happen with the worldwide outlook on that?
Okay.
Okay,
all right.
I'll get off the phone.
Thanks, Doug. Dwayne, thank you. I appreciate it.
You got a couple of Dougs already, right?
Yeah, a couple of Dougs. You're the only Dwayne other than my friend Dwayne at AIAA, but he never calls the show.
I am sure that your next caller is going to be John.
Well, we got probably more Johns than anyone else, right?
Yeah, right.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Have a good day. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye. So, listeners, we still have time if we take this to a two-hour show. And you're welcome to call us, 1-866-687-7223. I've got a couple of emails I can read while we wait and see if anyone else wants to give us a call. Adrian in San Diego says, hi, as far as the increase in popular support for raising the NASA space budget, we might as well be resigned that until when and if the equivalent of a Sputnik event occurs, no net increase will ever be realized. And we do have a caller on hold, so he or she will have to wait a minute. Regarding space law and treaties, I must agree with the caller, this would refer back to Chris from Wyoming, that when it comes to exploitation of extraterrestrial resources, the country company with the biggest stick will do it as well. No comments on the pathetic one-year mission initiative. Oh, I forgot to mention that. We should have mentioned that, darn it. This should have been the three-year mission, with every past ISS resident having been there already for at least a year, but not a year continuously, Adrian. They usually are up there between 4 and 6 months, and then they come back down, even if they've been up there multiple times. So, yes, we do have a one-year mission with, I think it's 2 cosmonauts and 1 NASA astronaut that will be there continuously for 1 year. It started the other day, and darn it, I apologize, listeners, I should have mentioned it. Anyway, that's Adrian's comment. We do have a caller on hold, but Kelly sent in a note. So he's referring back to the call with Chris about centrifuges. Where North Korea has only enough enrichment equipment to build a couple of prototype nuclear bombs, Iran built up hardened underground mass production facilities, builds and tests ICBM-range missiles, and funds North Korea's R&D of prototypes, Kelly. So that's what Kelly had to offer. And now we will turn to the phone and see who's calling. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you?
I guess he was right. This is John from Fort Worth.
Well, the odds were with him, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
What's up, John?
Well, I wanted to first of all, to make a comment about some stuff that was discussed earlier. You know, there was some discussion, I think, was it Tuesday night or whatever, about, or was it sometime earlier, about what Ms. Shotwell said about the Falcons and the Heavy and so forth.
Right.
And, well, looking at that material, I realized that, or I previously said I didn't see any way that they could reach the stay at 53 metric ton level of the Heavy. I based my calculations on the data that has been released about the Falcon 9 1.1 version being the basis for that, you know, cluster. Well, they're saying that, in fact, the side boosters are going to be a new generation or update to the 1.1, and that something else, even more powerful, will be the core stage on it. And, of course, that totally changes the picture. Of course, we don't know what that'll be, but I thought it would be worth making that comment there, given that what she'd said.
Okay.
So I don't know what they're planning on doing, but I guess we'll wait to see what they come up with. But, I mean, that's another stage, you know, in what they're doing. Now, they also made something about improving the performance of the Merlin engine. It's something about 30%. And I don't know 30% of what, because it's not 30% of ISP. I'm pretty sure of that. So, but I don't know what they're referring to there.
Jerry in Florida was sending us that information on that show. So
yeah, but that, I think we found that, and that was a reference that they made. So I don't know. I'm just saying that sort of changes the picture on if they're really going to develop another generation of hardware and under the Falcon, you know, label, but really it's something different. I mean, because the 1.1 is certainly much extended over what they had previously, you know.
Correct.
So I mean, it looks to me like they're almost running more of a prototyping shop than they are a production line. I mean, if they're making that many upgrades to these rockets, that's that significant as they go. I mean,
well, at some point they'll go into production because they won't keep making modifications.
Yeah, one would think so. So, at any rate, I just assumed they were going to use the already proven material, you know, so somebody said something differently, you know. But now they have apparently said something differently.
What else is on your mind?
Well, another thing, they were talking about the issue of this moon, orbiter. It's mapping the moon and taking out. I think that possibly what's going on here is maybe a bureaucratic budgetary tactic. That is to say, you know, we've got this level of budget, and you know, if you don't give us a little bit more money, we're going to really have to do something really stupid. In fact, it's not a priority, so we're taking it out of the budget. And then that's sort of, you know, they kind of played that game with the Hubble Space Telescope repair mission for a while. And then Congress kind of got spun up and said, no, we are going to do that, and so forth, right? So I'm wondering if this is a similar thing. Since it's such a low-budget item, maybe they can hope to squeeze a few million more dollars of budget that way.
I don't know. Could be a negotiating strategy. I don't have any information about that.
Obviously, if they're going to keep that close to I'm just saying that might be a way of looking at it. It's often in the defense world, you'll do things like, particularly if you have an item that's in production that there's a variety of vested interests want, you know, and you know there's a powerful senator on the Armed Services Committee that's going to make sure it's in the budget. You'll go, the Pentagon will go out there and they'll say, well, you know, don't put that in the budget, you know. And then what happens, of course, immediately, they know that Senator X is going to get motivated with Congressman Y, and they're going to put it back in the budget.
Well,
and then somebody will say, they funded such and such project, which the Pentagon said they don't even need, you know, but all the people involved know what's happening, and they know it's going to be put in there, and that way they hope to squeeze a little bit more money out than they would have got it, you know, otherwise, that kind of thing.
Well, I guess we'll find out when we see what happens with the budget negotiations, right?
Yeah, of course. I'm just trying to, you know, throw out an idea, a little different slant that might, but maybe not, be happening on some of those things.
It just seems foolish that they would cancel those two missions, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and Opportunity, which has been working for a really long time, way past its life expectancy.
It seems stupid to me, too. And that's why I'm saying it falls in that kind of category. Like, if you had something that would be in production and would cost a lot of money to put it back into production and you know you're going to need it, and then you don't put it in the budget, that seems kind of stupid, too. And I've seen that done in some areas in the past, let's just put it that way. And it, weirdly enough, it ended up getting funded, too.
And listeners, for those of you that are sports fans, this has nothing to do with space, but you chose to listen to the Space Show today rather than watch Michigan and Louisville in basketball. Michigan State has won the game 76-70 and advances to the Final Four. So I'm just giving you that little news alert. And I appreciate your listening to the show over watching the basketball game. Anything else, John?
Well, I guess that's about it. The other thing, while you were kind of discussing the issue of, you know, I don't think you're going to get anybody to agree to doubling the space budget in a single fiscal year. If you're going to do anything, it's going to have to be gradual to get increases. I think what we really probably need to be shooting for is to keep a percent of the budget, at least at half, and not have it fall to 4/10 to 3/10, in other words. I mean, what's been happening over the years is we really haven't been growing with the overall level of budgets, I don't think, for some time. You know, we've been kind of stuck at a fixed, linear number rather than actually growing.
Right.
And I think that's one thing that might be more sellable, you know, than trying to get them to double it. It's probably in a single year particularly, it's a little much. But if we could get off a dead center, that'd be good.
I didn't ask him that. I asked him about doubling from half of 1% to 1%.
Yeah.
And not with my money.
Not with your money.
Not with my money. That was the primary response. And since the government does everything with their money and your money and my money, then they're not in support of it. They wanted potholes fixed in San Francisco. One of them talked about actually fixing the electrical grid, because that has never been done, and our grid is in pretty bad shape, so most of us understand.
That might be an interesting point, too. I mean,
so they all had what they consider to be better uses for the money than putting it into space.
Well, but a lot of those, well, I like the grid. That might be a primary security issue. But the space does have an advantage of potentially paying for itself to some degree due to spinoffs that a lot of other purposes like potholes definitely wouldn't have.
Maybe.
I mean, the impact on GDP of space investment is a better, much better return in terms of the multiplier.
Well, and fixing potholes is a San Francisco County project, or maybe you can stretch it to the state. That's not a federal government responsibility.
Of course. I just thought I'd check in and make. I wanted to clarify that whole thing,
right?
Because some people may, you know, I mean, that's an update, and it shows, I think, that maybe I'm not wrong in what I'm saying, and maybe they have a plan to get to what they're saying. So, on the SpaceX.
All right. Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. So, listeners, this is a two-hour show, so it's a good point to take our conclusion here. So we do have shows tomorrow, as I told you, with Tony Milligan on his ethics book. Tuesday we have a show. Friday Bruce Damer comes back. And there will be no show on Sunday because Sunday is Easter, and we don't usually have an audience on Sunday for everybody's doing things with their families and stuff. So we'll have three shows this week, plus on Hotel Mars, Dr. Ben Arroyo, who's usually associated with doing things with the moon, he's taking us to Mars Wednesday night with John Batchelor on April Fools. And no, this is not a joke. The moon man is going to Mars. No April Fools. So I want to thank everybody for calling, for emailing, and for participating in today's program. And our open line show for April, so far I just have one planned, is going to be a Tuesday night. So it is on the website newsletter schedule when I publish the website newsletter later this afternoon or this evening. So I know you all are used to open lines on Sunday, but we are going to try one going back again on Tuesday night. I think it's April 21st. So put it on your calendar so you can listen and participate. So I know it's late for those of you on the East Coast, but come on, you're up watching late-night TV anyway. So hopefully you'll be able to tune us in for that Open Lines program. And so far, that's the only one I have planned for April. So thank you all again for tuning in. I hope everyone has a great rest of the weekend, a good week coming up. Remember, no show on Sunday. Check the newsletters for details of the programs this week. And everybody, keep looking up. You never know what you might see. And again, great having you participate with us on today's Space Show program. Bye, everybody.